One of the great joys of working on a program like Saturday Extra is that you constantly learn about the world and the country we live in. And my next guest has provided me with oodles of knowledge to reflect on with his hike last year along the 660k Australian Alps walking track. Yes, there is one. And indeed, it's not for the faint-hearted, nor perhaps advisable during the heat of our new summers, as Anthony Sharwood found out last year, as bushfires truly did race through the mountains. But his book, From Snow to Ash, Solitude, Soul Searching and Survival on Australia's Toughest Hiking Trail, not a short title, it's opened my eyes more to this unique landscape in Australia. We too often identify easily with the coast and then the bush and the outback, but rarely the mountains of Victoria, the ACT and New South Wales, along with the unique fauna and flora, as well as the townships and the people. We know vastly more, for instance, about that other unique ecosystem, the Great Barrier Reef, and threats to it, whereas the Australian Alps tend to be overlooked, which Anthony is on a mission to change. He's a hiker, he's a skier and a writer. And I'm looking forward, Anthony, to being converted to caring more. Welcome.
Thank you, Geraldine.
So, Ant, let's just get a bit of detail about where we are. Now, the high country, that's the Victorian term for the Australian Alps. The New South Welsh people call it the Snowy Mountains, and Canberrans, I think, call it the Brindabellas. We don't often refer to it as the Alps. Why do you think that is so?
Well, it's probably because we've kind of got one of those good Australian colloquial terms, like the high country, like that area out the back of Australia, as we call the outback. So we love our literal
names. Banjo-Paterson country, I always think of it as.
Oh, there you go. But I suppose our coverall term is the high country. But, you know, technically that part of the Great Dividing Range that reaches its highest point in southeast Australia across three states is called the Australian Alps. And the track that goes through it that I undertook last summer is the Australian Alps Walking Track, the AAWT. That's its official name. So I think our Alps aren't quite as jagged as those in Europe. They're older and more rounded, but I think we can pretty comfortably use the term Australian Alps. And this is a tough track. This feels like, I'm fortunate enough to have hiked the Alps, Geraldine, and I can tell you that the hiking down in our high country is absolutely as tough. The Australian Alps Walking Track is not like the Milford Track in New Zealand. It's not like Tasmania's Overland Track. These are tracks that have facilities along the way. They have huts. You can take guided tours. There are a lot of boardwalks and that sort of thing. The Australian Alps Walking Track is almost a route. It's almost an idea, Geraldine. There are no facilities. It's a six-week undertaking. You have to leave food in drops buried in the bush. You really have to approach it as you would almost an expedition.
How many do it each year?
It's estimated that only about 100 parties, and most of those parties are soloists like me. Not really a track you're going to do with more than two or three or four people because it's so difficult. So it's not a very well-known route, but it passes near the ski resorts, and it does go right next to Mount Kosciuszko, and it does go through some of the really, really popular areas of the Australian Alps, like Falls Creek to Mount Hotham in Victoria, between those two ski resorts. So you link up with hiking trails, you link up with fire trails, but in other areas, you're actually following a ridge or a valley or a creek, and you need remote area navigation, you need maps, you need a couple of apps on your phone if you want to do it that way. And it's a very difficult, self-reliant undertaking. But that's what I wanted to do, Geraldine. I've loved the Aussie high country my whole life, and I wanted to see every single inch of it, from southern Gippsland where it starts or finishes, depending which way you go, all the way through to the ACT where it ends up. And, you know, I got most of it done before the Black Summer had its say.
Oh, we're going to come back to that because you only just did. You want to use it as a paean of praise to the place rather than, you know, a great adventure story, although you do talk beautifully about the snow gums, which is when you're skiing up there, you never... Yep. To me, take your eyes off the snow gums, and that's a real highlight for you, isn't it?
It is. I mean, there are so many beautiful things, Geraldine, in the Australian high country. The snow gums are magnificent. The the colours that their bark goes, the way that they're slender in the lower elevations and stumpy, and you can almost see them hunched against the wind at the higher elevations. And one of the things that I've come to realise, and it's tragic, is that the snow gums are in a lot of danger. There are many problems affecting the snow gums, and especially the alpine ash at lower elevations. But the main one, of course, is fire. There was a fire that swept across the entire Australian Alps in 1939. They called that the Black Friday fires, because it actually did start on a Friday the 13th. That was the one and only major Alps-wide fire of the 20th century. We've had three already in the 21st century, and we're only 20 years in. What people don't understand, people say to me, yeah, but they'll just sprout new leaves. Doesn't happen like that. The eucalypts of the high country do not have what's called epicormic growth, which is where the shoots spring out of the trunk, and we've all sort of seen those almost furry-looking gum trees in areas that burnt last summer. We've all seen that somewhere at some time. They don't do that in the high country, Geraldine. The alpine ash, for example, needs seeds to sprout out of the ground, and if the forest burns twice in 20 years, you destroy the seed bank. And that's what's happened in parts of New South Wales this summer. The last two megafires, 2003 and 2020, were 17 years apart. They just got there 3 years early, last year's fires. And that means that vast tracts of alpine ash forest, which is the second tallest flowering plant in the world, and they're sort of the precursor to the snow gums higher up, they're gone. They're gone forever. They're going to become a scrubby heathland.
Dear, oh dear. Look, this is what's so interesting. So clearly the mountains are entering a precarious phase of life, just like the Great Barrier Reef is. And you, in fact, say that 2006 was quite a pivotal year. But why don't we even focus on the Alps the way we certainly do on the Barrier Reef?
Well, it comes to what I said earlier about mountains being these hulking, tough things that we don't think about in the same way as fragile little corals, you know, which just are delicate. But the things that make the Alps special are delicate. And, you know, you mentioned 2006. That was the year of the lowest snow ever, Alps-wide. It was only the second year ever that there was not a metre of snow at the highest point, which has been measured for almost 60 years by Snowy Hydro in New South Wales. And declining snow cover doesn't just mean worse ski seasons. It means a changing ecology in so many ways. There's a gorgeous little creature, the mountain pygmy possum. It needs snow to keep warm. That doesn't make sense. How do you need snow to keep warm? Because snow at a certain depth forms an insulating blanket. The insulating blanket, the thicker it is, it's always zero under the snow, which is actually quite warm if you're a hibernating pygmy possum, you know, when it's minus 14. But if you're not getting the snow cover, that's just one example, Geraldine. The Bogong moths failed in recent years, and they feed all sorts of animals up there. And there are so many things going on in the Alps. And when I wrote From Snow to Ash, when I sat down and started writing a hiking novel, I had a vague awareness of these things, and I just wanted to take people on this hike. But it almost became intellectually irresponsible of me without getting on the phone and doing what a journalist does and calling the Bogong moth guy and calling the ecologist and calling the hut's historian and calling all the right people, so that in this book you see and feel and experience the Australian Alps through my eyes, but you understand them through the experts' eyes, and we need to understand them.
Well, let me just ask you, though, about the towns, the people in the towns who really helped you out, so you asked a lot of questions, and the book puts a spotlight on both the Alps and the people who live around them. How are they surviving? Are they dwindling, or do you get a sense that people are moving to the mountains instead of a sort of a sea change, a mountain change?
Yeah, absolutely. A ski change, let's call it. I think the state of the Jindabyne property market tells you a lot of what you need to know, and that is that Sydney money has bought heavily into it in recent years, and locals are all having a whinge about how you can't buy a house anymore. So there is definitely a movement towards the mountains. But there are two sides to the mountains. There's that touristy side, Geraldine, and there's the side that's still making a living from cattle farming and other activities. And, you know, I stopped for a couple of days in a town called Benambra. Well, I was camped down on the river where one of my food drops were on the Mitta Mitta River. And, you know, there was a grass fire that came down on the campsite and everyone was evacuated and people in Benambra looked after me and I went to the pub and everyone told tales about the old days. And so that fantastic high country bush heritage is well and truly alive in the high country towns that are dotted around.
Look, I have to ask you about being caught in the fires. You were you were very lucky, actually. You were airlifted out by a helicopter who was searching for a solo hiker, and you knew something was up with the falling ash and the burnt leaves, but you really had no idea that such an intense fire was heading your way. And there's a marvellous moment where you ask for 2 minutes to pack your gear and you're given one. But the ferocity and the speed of that fire was something else, wasn't it?
It was. And, you know, I really want to make it clear to listeners that I wasn't dopey and stumbling off into the black summer with fires all around me. The black summer started north and crept south. There were winter fires in Queensland. There were spring fires in northern New South Wales. It crept down the coast. The Australian Alps did have a couple of small fires in October, November, but they were doused. And most of December, when I was walking, was blissfully fire-free. So I really wasn't sort of rolling the dice and being stupid about it. But in the last week, everything started changing. And I was all over the fires app. It was really one day at a time sort of stuff. The fire that resulted in me being the last person evacuated from Kosciuszko National Park on New Year's Eve 2019 was a thing called the Duns Road Fire, and it moved quicker than Kosciuszko Chief Fire Officer Ian Dicker had ever seen. Now, Dicker's been the fire officer there for 18 years, and of course he was one of the people I interviewed at length for my book. And he said no one in the department had ever seen a fire come from so far away, move so quickly, and attack Kosciuszko. And it ended up burning a third of the park. Not just that fire, but fires burnt a third of the park. Mm-hmm. And it is New South Wales's largest national park, so it's a lot of territory burnt. And yes, there were signs, there were falling ash, but the leaves that were falling weren't snow gum leaves. They have a distinctive grain, and so I was doing a bit of CSI leaf analysis, and I felt safe because I knew that snow gum forests weren't burning, but of course, even though the fire was a long way away, it came so quickly. And, you know, when I ascended that helicopter, what I saw was unbelievable. I saw a towering plume of flame and smoke that seemed to stretch to the stratosphere. It was just horrific. It really, really had just come out of nowhere as far as I was concerned. And that was the end of the hike, about 110 k's from the end, unfortunately. But fortunately, I got out.
I'm very happy you did get out. And hopefully, in a way, despite your publicising it, I hope the track remains difficult to limit the impact of humans. And next time we talk to you, we might talk to you about Brumbies, because that's another whole thing that you discovered and that you're researching now, the impact of Brumbies on the park. So, Anthony Sharwood, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much, Geraldine.
Anthony Sharwood, who tackled the Australian Alps walking track, fair verb, I think, tackling, and his book about this precious part of Australia is called From Snow to Ash, and it's published by Hachette Australia.